Welcome to Coaching Uncaged, the podcast on all things coaching, brought to you by Animas. And now introducing your host, Yannick Jacob.
Okay. Wonderful. Claire Patrick, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me, Yannick.
I'm really excited about this. I just mentioned it, like your name keeps popping up everywhere recently, at least for me. And it might be the kind of sphere of coaching that I'm in. Your book, Simplifying Coaching, has been mentioned a number of times. So that's something I'm really curious about. But just by means of introduction, I hate reading bios, as people who listen to this podcast probably know by now. But you're an MCC with a ton of hours. Last time I read something, it was 13,000.
I don't know how many.
I heard tens of thousands. Do you have any way of keeping track?
I haven't kept a log for 10 years. Huh. Listener, beware, if you're going for coaching credential, don't do what I've just said.
Yeah.
When I got my MCC, I stopped logging them I don't know. I get 16,000 something, 17,000. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. And this was in 2012, right? I think you were one of the first ones who were accredited by the new MCC framework by the ICF back when it was changed.
Yes. So, yeah, I was. And part of that was annoying. In that, right up to that date, you could become a piece at an MCC if you just had the hours. Mm-hmm. So you'd get your PCC upgraded, and then they changed the system, and I had to do submit to recordings and all of that stuff. So that was annoying, but also I'm deeply grateful because I know it made me a better coach.
Yeah, that's what a lot of people say who go for accreditation and have some questions or some doubts around the value of accreditation. Everybody who does go through the process says they're a better coach for it.
Absolutely. You know? Because it makes you deal with your habits. Mm-hmm. So now I do loads of mental coaching, and I think the people I work with would agree. It's terrifying because you realize what you've been doing and where you've got sloppy and all of that stuff. Yeah. But it also gives it, I think it enables us to give more value to the people we coach. So that's great.
Yeah. And I think it's terrifying for a lot of coaches who might not be so keen to question and to doubt and to, you know, review their approach to coaching or the things that they do.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. And we do a lot of work with people around how to listen to a recording. In fact, I think I'm going to do a podcast on our Coaching In podcast about that, because I did a session earlier this week and that was the question they brought, and it was brilliant. We did some really good stuff. But I would say if your listeners want one little tip to take away, it would be when you're listening to a recording of you coaching, don't listen to yourself.
Don't listen to yourself?
No.
What to listen to then?
Listen to the other person and to listen to the transition between what you say and when and how they come back, because then you'll be able to tell whether you're interrupting them, whether they're thinking.
Yeah.
And all those good things.
Oh, that's fantastic advice. I mean, take a moment if you're listening to this, and if somebody told you to listen to a recording of yourself for 2 hours, what's your reaction? I produced a bit of music back in my day, and so I've listened to a whole lot of my own voice, and I think that really helped to desensitize myself. I still don't enjoy it, you know, as such. But it's such an interesting, curious moment when you're faced with yourself.
Yeah. And also the voice we hear that's ours isn't the voice we hear on a recording, because it's something to do with the bones in the head.
Yeah, that's right.
So we think we're higher than we thought we were.
Yeah, exactly. So it can be quite a cathartic experience to listen to ourselves, but most people find it quite strange. And yet there's so much to learn in there, but it seems to take a lot of courage to actually be doing that.
Yeah. So another tipette is just record everything, because then I think you get a bit less anxious about it.
Yeah. Obviously within confidentiality and permission, but if you just get into a habit of recording yourself, you don't need a client to record yourself and listen to yourself, just to kind of get used to listening to yourself.
Yeah, totally. Yes.
Right. So 30 years of experience plus, you know, been coaching a whole lot. You've done a lot of hours, a lot of training, a lot of writing. Is there anything that you would add to who you are? Because I think some people can really find it helpful to get a bit of a sense of where you're talking from.
I am not a guru. Just to nail that right to the mast. Uh-huh. You've just asked me to be honest. I think I've got a third class degree in a subject I hated, which was a huge celebration on graduation day because I thought I was going to fail. I hated it. I completely took the wrong career path to start with. But, uh-huh. And I wouldn't be where I am now if I hadn't taken the wrong degree. Because that led to the next thing, and that led to the next thing, and that led to coaching. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so I've got a third class degree. There you are. That's another piece of information about me.
I love that. I want to start with a quote I sometimes mention, because it reminded me of your simplifying coaching concept. I think it was by Voltaire. Voltaire once wrote a letter and started with apologies. I'm paraphrasing probably. Apologies for writing such a long letter. I didn't have time to write a short one. And I think it speaks to so much about, well, doing less, doing more. Many people now have understood that doing less might be doing more. And I think more and more people understand that doing less is actually takes a lot of work.
It does.
Writing a short letter takes a lot of work. That's why it takes such a long time. Whereas a lot of coaches still think the more I do, the more value I provide.
Yes.
So I just wanted to open that door and see what comes out of you.
I think it's a fantasy that we add value by trying to add value, because trying to add too much value really impacts partnership, because now this is about me proving to the person that I'm with in the room that I've got extra jolly fancy bits to go in. And so that need for me to do that makes them smaller. And then we're out of partnership because there's me and my beautiful value. And they're smaller than I am. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, but it is an art, and it takes confidence to do less, because if somebody's paying you a lot of money, I know not all coaches earn a lot of money, but, you know, if you're in there and they're paying you any money, actually, or even if they're not paying you any money at all, what are you there for if it's not to look as though you're there? And actually, we're there, you know, our role is to be with them in mm-hmm. service of facilitating them to do some good work. It's not to be seen to be doing the good work ourselves, but in every other single aspect of life, it looks as though we should be doing stuff. Mm-hmm. So it is very upside down, I would say.
Mm-hmm. And that seems to be a contracting thing. Right. It seems to be so important that in that partnership, as we forge that partnership, the partner understands that the value we provide and the role that the coach offers here is not one of adding value or exchanging knowledge or transferring their learning to you. How do you have those contracting conversations so that it's clear that your partner, your coaching partner, understands that?
I don't say very much. I just say, are you ready to do some good work? Uh-huh. And then I ask questions that help us work out what the work is. And then I say, how are we going to do this? Which means, because we're not going to do it my way. Mm-hmm. And they say, I don't know, usually. And then I say, that's okay. Where should we start? And then off we go. So I don't do a huge setup, because one of the issues about a long setup, we need to talk about coaching isn't about this and it is about this. I'm teaching them what coaching is. And when I teach them what coaching is, they think I'm going to teach them, even mm-hmm. though I've just taught them that it isn't about teaching. Mm-hmm. They still experience that as being told.
Right.
So then they start following.
Yeah, and then you're in a leading following dynamic.
And then, yeah, once they're following, it's really hard to turn it around. And do you know, on a little tangent. That's true whatever you do that's about following and leading. Mm-hmm. So you might say, let's do a breathing exercise to arrive. That's leading.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, whereas, of course.
Whereas if they go, oh, my goodness, I'm all over the place, can't breathe, oh, I can't start. And you say, what do we need to do to arrive? And they say, I'd like to do a breathing exercise. Mm-hmm. And you say, are you leading it or am I?
Yeah. I imagine that to be a bit tricky, though, when somebody comes in and they're like, oh, my God, exactly what you just said. And you just know a breathing exercise would be just so helpful to them. But they don't come up with it, you know. You just let that go then, I'm assuming.
I would just ask them, you know, what do we need to do so you arrive? Uh-huh. And then if they're not breathing, then I'll say, I notice you're not breathing.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think what I'm discovering more and more is that there's no end to the work that we can do and the work we can let go of to be fully working in partnership.
Mm-hmm.
And the more experienced the coaches that I work with are, the more I notice the beginning and how the beginning impacts. So somebody will present a recording in a mentor coaching session and they'll go, it wasn't very good.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll say, that's okay, let's listen. And you'll listen to the first minute of the recording and it won't be in partnership. And then I'll say, let's not worry about the fact it wasn't very good because it's not going to be so because this little thing happened at the beginning,
mm-hmm.
meant that you weren't in partnership. So if you were able to turn it around at all, that's amazing.
Yeah.
But let's not get self-critical about listening to the whole of the rest of the thing. When we know that something happened at the beginning which impacted partnership, which probably means you won't get it back.
Yeah, that sounds a bit leading in terms of the process, right? The let's not worry about that fact is offering something.
That's in mental coaching, which isn't coaching.
Right, yeah.
So that's me when I'm listening with a recording to somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't want to put them through the pain of listening to the recording that they've already listened to on their own and gone, oh my goodness, that wasn't very good.
Yeah.
Because the learning is there in what happened in that first few seconds.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, and there's so much learning in all of the seconds in my experience.
Absolutely.
I'm just going a little bit back to the beginning, to the very beginning when you set it up. I wonder what happens if a client explicitly asks you for mentoring or asks the coach to be leading this. If it's client-led and you don't have that kind of exchange around, what do you think this is? What do I think this is? How can we form this in a way that's going to work best for you? What if they don't want coaching?
I don't take any notice. There's something in the before you start doing the work when I say, you know, I do say when we have the chat, let's be clear that this is about me helping you to do some good work. Mm-hmm. But it's really common, isn't it? When you have a coaching session and somebody says, I'd really want to know your opinion on that.
Yeah.
I don't say, I'm not going to have an opinion on that. I just don't say anything. I just say, so what's the best way for us to do this? You know, where are we going to start? And, you know, you always get to the end and they didn't need anything anyway.
Huh. So that you just kind of ignore their request and just do what you would do anyway, and usually it works out well.
Yeah, people do what they normally do when they are where they normally are.
Mm-hmm.
So if they're in a one-to-one with somebody, what they normally do is they ask the other person for their wisdom. So that's what normally happens.
Yeah.
And here we are in this strange conversation that looks so much like other conversations and is actually so completely different.
Mm-hmm.
I think that even if you explain absolutely everything, they still won't really know what it's like unless they experience it.
Yeah.
So just diving into what we need to do is useful. So when they go, I hope you'll come up with a load of suggestions for me, I go, okay, what do we need to do now?
Well, I would find that risky if I put myself in that situation, just because on some level I would think, they think we have an agreement that I'm going to do that at some point. So 3 sessions, 4 sessions, 5 sessions down the line, they might come back on that. And I didn't say no. So they might have thought that I agreed to it.
Yeah, but there's also, if you turn it into a teaching about, now I'm going to explain to you the difference between coaching and mentoring and other interventions. You know, in coaching, we do this and we do this, and they go, what? Is that weird? I mean, I think there's wisdom in when you do it and what you do. You know, if you find yourself in a conversation with somebody who's come for the first session and they barely say anything.
Yeah.
And it's all very awkward. Then I would say, you know, what do you need to know, or what do we need to talk about so that you trust me enough to be able for us to be able to do some good work today?
Mm-hmm.
And then it might come out then. But usually my experience is people are just ready to dive in.
Mm.
I mean, the readiness will look different, and somebody will look barely ready, and somebody else is going, actually, I want to do all of these things.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, we have to say, what's my ethical compass here?
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's not to become litigious about everything they say, and because I think that negatively impacts trust and intimacy and presence.
Yeah.
And it takes wisdom, and sometimes we get it wrong.
Yeah, I think it's so important that people experience what this is. Often it's difficult to put coaching really into words, and even if the words are quite clear for you, how they land with another person, you never know, because language is such a flimsy instrument.
Yeah. And when I listen to recordings, when people have done that at the beginning, you can tell, because the partnership is difficult to regain later on.
In my experience, it can be done in a way that isn't a teaching of what this is and do you agree, yes or no. It's like some of the teaching I've done reviewing coaching videos. One of my markers once commented that it feels like the coach is reading the client their rights.
Yes. And then
the client goes, yes, that's okay. And then they start the coaching when, you know, the first couple of minutes, whether this is a contracting conversation or not a contracting conversation, you're forming a partnership.
Yeah.
And so being curious about what this is for you, or what your expectations are, what your concerns are, you know, this can be a very free flowing conversation where I don't necessarily say a lot.
Yeah.
But for me, it's really important that this contracting stage, there is an exchange of some sort. And if somebody has a very different idea of what coaching is compared to what my idea of coaching is, I feel it's really important that we arrive on common ground so that we can both agree to engage in this.
And that's being clear, isn't it, about what's the arriving conversation and what's the work?
Yeah.
And getting a boundary between the arriving and the work, because when we don't have a boundary between the arriving and the work, that's when we get into these difficulties of following.
Yeah, and this is where it's not a dilemma is a big word, but like the juxtaposition between complexity and simplification is really, really interesting to me, because I really value complexity. I seek complexity in many ways, just because I kind of revel in it. I find it immensely interesting. I think the world is a hugely complex place. People are hugely complex. At the same time, I really believe in simplifying this coaching. I think in essence, if we're just showing up and we're super present and we feed back what we observe and we're being really curious, if we only have that, we're probably a really good coach. We really deliver value.
Yeah.
At the same time, there is a complexity around contracting and there's nuance around it. And I haven't quite made up my mind where to swing or what the balance is or how to navigate that. It's usually a context by context basis.
Yeah. And I think my philosophy now is, what's the least that I need to do in this conversation so that they feel heard and they get new insights into their own stuff?
It reminds me of my attitude when I was 15 and in school. What's the least
What's
I have
the least
to do?
I need to do to get through this? Well, that's like me and my degree. But can I just say, in my degree, I didn't get any new insights because I wasn't doing any work.
Yeah, it's a very different what's the least I can do here. I think what's really important to underline is, as a coach, when we do the least we need to do in order to deliver value, is we don't interfere with our clients' thinking, or we do that as little as possible. And I really noticed that at MCC level, the coach speaks so much less than most other coaches I know, because it's not necessary. And I noticed that when I coach, I didn't need to explain that question. You know, I didn't need to offer a lot of context for this or that.
Can I tell you why you didn't need to explain that question? Because they were there when you heard the bit that they said that made you come up with the question. Mm-hmm. Now, I know that's crazy, stupid thing to say, but I am always saying that to coaches. They were there. Mm-hmm. When they said the thing that they just said to you that caused that question, they were there. They heard it too.
So, but we hear things very differently, don't we?
Yes, but we don't need to explain. We really don't. But I think one of the things about what's the least I need to do is that the more training you've done, I'm picking up the bin here, but the more training, not because it's rubbish, but because it's a container that's close to me, but the more training you've done, the more goodies you've got in your goodie bag.
Mm-hmm.
But the more you look in your goodie bag for the next good thing you can do,
the less you pay attention. Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you might need to slip your hand in and bring something out and use something.
Yeah.
But the most effective tool in the conversation is the person who's with us. They have got all their brilliance and their wonderful things. And, you know, if we're really paying attention, then the questions will emerge in the space between us from them.
Yeah.
And we'll work out what to do. So I was coaching somebody the other day and she said, I need to build it. So I said, have you got anything around you that you can build it with? And she said, oh, yeah, I've got some bricks here. So she picks up this stack of Lego blocks and they were all stuck together. And she'd said, I need some bricks I can build it with. And I said, oh, I noticed that your bricks are all stuck together. And that was the unlocker.
Huh.
Now that tool came because she said that's what we needed to do. She said, I need some bricks I can build it with.
Yeah.
So I'm listening for what they're telling me we need to do. And they tell us.
Yeah.
And there's then it's easy.
Yeah, there's a really deep trust in the client knowing what to do and being resourced to find the answer.
Yeah,
you know, absolutely. And that's really sits at the heart of coaching, of that kind of coaching.
Yeah. 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 They'll tell us and we just need to be looking and listening and sensing.
Let's talk about models for a moment, because I heard you in another interview. I think you picked up the same bin.
Did I? I only have one bin.
In the context of simplifying coaching, it strikes me that in the beginning, when coaches become coaches or start adding a formal framework around what coaching is, let's say, because a lot of people, they already have a lot of the skills that they need for coaching, already have that. But when people start framing it, it feels like models by definition, they simplify things, right? They take something that's complex and they try to illustrate it in a simple way so that, you know, we can understand it and it can guide some of how we think and what we do. And I feel in the beginning, that's quite helpful for a coach because I kind of know what this is now, but then, you know, it's clunky and we hold on to the models. But at some point we start internalizing them to an extent where they're just kind of, they become us. And I've noticed that again and again, supervising sessions or reflecting on my own, that this or that model, I didn't think about it anymore, but it just kind of came out naturally by what I'm curious about. So there's this interesting thing about models, how they are in the way, but they're really helpful once they become us.
Yeah. And I think once they become us, and probably we don't use them in their full entirety, and we only use a tiny little bit, and we only use as much as is necessary, and then we drop it. So there's something about being unattached.
I think
one of the things that bothers me about lots of models is that the coach is so confused in the early days, which is why we don't really teach models in our training. The coach is really confused in the early days. Well, which model do I do and how do I do this properly? And, you know, that inner chatter is overwhelming, absolutely overwhelming. And you must have listened to recordings where it sounds like the thinker is being pulled along in service of something else.
And
how do we make this thing that's called coaching an encounter between two human beings? Because what makes it weird is that it's only about one of us, whereas most other conversations are about both of us, aren't they? So we're talking here, you and I, sharing together. This is a dialogue, whereas almost a coaching session is a facilitating a monologue and only putting in as much as you need to do for them to be able to continue to have that conversation with themselves. Because I don't need any of that information. But we can, I heard somebody describing beginner early coaching the other day as like a rifle range. And having the whole thing lined up, you know, it's absolutely overwhelming to both parties, I think. So let's lighten up.
Yeah, because it's just so distracting. And I can hear it so loud in supervision when coaches come in and they have all of these thoughts during the session. And I'm like, with all that noise, like how are you able to pay attention? You know, as soon as we think about what question to ask next or what's the next stage in the model, we're just not present, at least, at the very least, not as present as we could be.
And we also probably miss the really great thing that needed to happen next, which they're about to tell us with their body or their voice or their something.
You mentioned a few terms around how to call this person that we're working with. And I've talked to Peter Hawkins a little while ago on this podcast as well. And he brought up a similar thing. It's like, why do we call them clients? That implies that, you know, they pay us for a service. You mentioned a coachee or a supervisee, you know, the E, and somebody who was quite offended at being called an E. A thinking partner, Nancy Klein, talked about, but it didn't really catch on. At least I don't really hear it a lot. But there's something I quite like to kind of get away from. I'm the service provider and you pay me in order to get something and I help you. Because really it's two human beings who are coming together. Yeah. Where are you with how you call the people that you work with or the people that come into the space to do work together?
I am a work in progress, Yannick. So I think one of the dangers of coachy client or any of those words makes it sound as though I'm sorted and you're not. Well, that's not true. I'm not sorted and you're more sorted than you think you are. You know, it really puts us out of balance. And I think with coaching being integrated as a style of leadership in the workplace, how can you call your colleague a client? Well, you can't. And I actually think it's quite offensive to call your colleague a coachee too. They're a person, they're a colleague. So I'm having a conversation with my colleague, which is facilitating their thinking. So in the book, I use the word thinker. It's not perfect because it doesn't include the whole thing about feeling or sensing or any of those things, but it'll do. But then when I hear people talking about my thinkers, I kind of go, the same way that I also am really quite disturbed when I hear people go, my client. They're not yours. They're not your coachee. They're not my coachee. They're not my thinker. They are people who have agency and wonder and beautiful stuff. So I don't know is the answer to your question, but maybe, you know, people have come up with lots of ideas, explorers, but nothing quite does it apart from person.
Yeah, it gets harder to sell, you know, if we have a certain reputation and like we know people, we have conversations regularly that kind of help people. We at some point in coaching, we don't need to worry about that so much anymore.
Yeah.
But I think especially coaches who are starting out, there's so many of them now that it's not enough anymore to just tune into people because there's so many coaches to choose from. And you know, people, before they invest in something, they tend to want to have some degree of certainty that this is going to help them.
I agree.
And with the kind of code. Yeah, go on.
Can we talk about that? Because I had a revelation yesterday.
Oh.
So I was doing a webinar for a group of coaching students and they wanted to know about business building. Mm-hmm. And one of them asked me a question about a niche. And I said, I've always been really averse to niches. Which I have. And I'm looking at them and my screen is full of newly qualified coaches, the whole screen. And I looked at them and I thought, I don't like the idea of a niche because I didn't need to have one. Because when I started coaching in 1998, I could tell you the names of the coaches in the UK. I could say, you know, there's this person and this person and this person. So of course we didn't need to niche.
Yeah.
We had to persuade people or explain to people what coaching was, and we had to do a different path, but we so didn't need to niche. Whereas now, as you say, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of coaches.
Yeah.
So we've got to say what's our differential.
Mm-hmm.
And then I worked out what mine was after all these years. I was so pleased with myself. So that was fun.
Would you mind sharing?
My niche.
Yeah.
Well, actually, the niche of our business is single session coaching.
I've had that on my list. We're going to explore that later.
Oh, are we? So,
oh, yeah.
So I don't know. They've got a WhatsApp group and apparently they were sharing this morning. And so, I think they were a bit startled by my revelation that, you know, here am I talking about coaching all the time. And there's something I had completely blindsided. I just not noticed. But I was talking to colleagues this morning and it's been, you know, I think after 30, however many years, at last I know what it is.
I find that fascinating how sometimes the niche is so obvious to other people and to us, it's just, we can't really see it.
Yeah, exactly.
Also, what I always like to mention when it comes around niching, I think it only really matters when we're speaking first. At least from in a marketing context, it's hugely helpful to think about it because it gets you to focus a little bit more and it gets you to reflect on what you like doing, what's well received, what's really helpful, and kind of try to see where the overlaps between those are. But when it comes to acquiring clients, I think we really need to know who we're speaking to if we're the ones speaking first via a book or a blog post or an advertising. You know, because then we're the ones addressing someone. If we just say, hey, you know, some people might turn around, but, you know, it's really helpful to know who we're speaking about. But if the other person speaks first and we find ourselves in a conversation with them, we don't need to know because when we work as a coach in the way that you've sketched it out, you know, I don't need to know. No. I don't need to have any knowledge about what it is that you want to make progress on. I sometimes don't even need to understand what it is the hell you're talking about, you know? So I think the whole niching thing becomes important in an overcrowded market when we choose to speak first.
Who Speaks First is the title of a book that I'm never going to write, but it's a concept that I think about a lot. Who speaks first? Because it's the same in the coaching space. Who speaks first when there's been a silence? I'll give you that title. Because I'd love to hear what you had to say about the rest of it, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. We can put what we offer, what we can have, what we can provide in terms of support. We can put that into the relation of, into the context of what you just told me you're struggling with or you desire.
Yeah.
You know, and chances are coaching can help you if, you know, that's the kind of path you would like to try out. I really believe in that.
Absolutely.
I just don't need to know. I was reminded, I heard a bit from you on another podcast, I think it was, And it reminded me of a practice session I had in my own training. And my client in this kind of short coaching session didn't want to share what it was that they wanted to talk about. Maybe it was something embarrassing, maybe something illegal. I don't know, you know, but they didn't want to share what the content was. And we agreed to give it a try anyway. And then, you know, I just picked up what I noticed and, you know, we had a really productive session. And to this day, I have no clue what it was about. They found a solution. They found a way forward, but I have no clue what it was.
Yeah. I love it when that happens. Uh-huh. And you know, when I see those people again, I can absolutely go back to that moment of the conversation and remember it. But of course, I remember nothing. But they look at me and they think I know what it was.
Yeah. And it happens so often, right? People tell me, oh, yeah, I think you're right. And like, I don't even know what you're talking about. How can I be right?
Yeah, exactly. Mm. Yeah, so funny.
Yeah. So tell me about single session coaching, because I've talked to Wendy Dryden for a little while to involve him in a course at some point. And this is the first time I heard single session coaching and single session therapy coming up. In single session therapy, it seemed quite radical. In coaching, it happens quite a lot. But you seem to have done a lot of thinking around this. And given that this is now your niche of 3D coaching, can you tell us a little bit more around the framework, the concept of it?
Well, when I submitted my ACC back in 100 years ago, I had to check in that they were okay, that I was doing, that almost my whole coaching log at that point was single session coaching.
All right. So you've been doing it for a while.
And they said, but if that's what you do, then of course you can put it in your coaching log. So let me start with what I know now that I didn't know then. So when then I knew that it worked.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean by work?
People have moved forward in their thinking and they don't need any more from you at the moment. Mm-hmm. What I know now is that Teresa Amabile from Harvard and her co-author, somebody Kramer, wrote a book called The Progress Principle. Mm. And one of the things in the progress principle is that any progress is progress. Mm-hmm. So what I notice is that some people need somebody to travel with them over time, mm-hmm. to be an accountability partner and to check in as they go and to go deeper and deeper and deeper, mm-hmm. or not go deeper and deeper and deeper sometimes.
Yeah.
Other people need a bit of unlocking. Mm-hmm. And once they've had the unlocking, then they can do the rest on their own. And at some point in the future, they'll probably come back for more because they'll want some more unlocking. So most of the people I've done single sessions with, often they've come back for another one at another time.
Yeah.
But the benefit of single session coaching is the stakes are high because mm-hmm. we need to get some good work done. Mm-hmm. But they understand that's what it's for. Mm-hmm. And therefore they're really up for high stakes. You can't do any context setting.
Yeah.
And well, I mean, I've had an incident recently where it was like 5 minutes. Huh. Maybe it was 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. And actually they went, my whole environment has changed so much because I said what I noticed on their face. Mm-hmm. I said, well, what do you want to do? I think there's something about single session coaching. And that was a 4-session contract. And this was like 10 minutes to the first session. And I said, well, what do you want us to do right now? And they went, I don't know. And I said, well, we could sit with it together, which we did for a bit. We could do something else, but that doesn't feel like it's a good idea. Or we could stop. You know, we could do something else. Let's work out what's the best thing to do. And they said, oh, I want to sit with it for a bit. So we sat together. And then I said, so where are we? And they said, I think I've done absolutely everything I need to do today. That was absolutely amazing. And I still don't know what happened. But anyway, they said that was absolutely amazing. I've done what I need to do. And they said, it's shifted everything. Huh. So I said, I'm just wondering about our next 3 sessions. And he went, no, I don't need those. Hmm. And I said, I agree. I don't think you do. And I said, you know where I am. Hmm. So If you can, if you do a really good right sizing at the beginning of a coaching session and you're really clear what's the actual work we need to do here. Now, sometimes that takes the whole session to find out what's the work. Sometimes it takes weeks to find out the work, but often people who buy into single session coaching trust the process.
And they know quite well what they want from the process.
Yeah. And they come and they usually get more than they expected. So I don't do discovery sessions. I don't do chemistry sessions because otherwise we've done in the jolly discovery session what we've done in the single session and they don't pay any money and off they go. So no, I don't do that. So it's been I think it's made me a better coach. But I met a lovely lady, and I talk about this in the book. She was doing her ILM level 7 coach training, and they were told they had to do 6 sessions. And she came very disheartened to a workshop that I was doing for disheartened coaches. And the organization was paying me to kind of support them to get their the love back. And she said, but the last coaching relationship I had was awful. She said, the first session was amazing. The second session was okay. The third session wasn't very good. I can't remember if she got to 4 or 5. And then she said, and then they just didn't book anymore. So I can't be very good.
Oh, what a shame.
And I said, what if you did the bulk of the work they needed in session one? And this is particularly true, I think. It's ironic, isn't it, that in organisations, people are commissioned to do 6 sessions of coaching. And yet, those are the places where quite a number of people who go for the coaching don't know what it is. They're not sure how much transformational work. If you ask them afterwards, how much transformational work do you think you wanted to do? They'd have probably said not very much. And I just, they do sort of transactional stuff. Yet they get given 6 sessions, and yet you get a private, somebody who pays for themselves in 6 sessions. You'll go deep, you'll go, you know, you'll do all sorts of things. So I think organizations are spending an awful lot of money on 6 sessions of coaching when actually a single
session, 1 or 2 would have been enough.
And do we need another one? Is actually what the person needs. And sometimes it does go deep and sometimes more is useful.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can do it in one.
Yeah. Two things I wanted to add there and a question I wanted to ask. One thing is David Clutterbuck once mentioned that many people think the goal of coaching is to help somebody achieve this or that goal. And that's not how he sees it, but that the role of the coach is to help somebody make progress in their thinking.
Yes.
You know, help somebody make progress. It could be any progress.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the second thing I'm thinking of, I really like the metaphor of the fellow traveler as a coach. And if you think about a fellow traveler, some people you travel with for weeks or for months, and that has a huge impact on your life. But sometimes you're on a journey and you meet somebody for one evening, just one conversation, and that really shifts something. And maybe you have another fellow traveler that you then, you know, integrate and reflect or whatever, you know, but really, it does not necessarily about the amount of time you spend together. It's about the amount of progress you've managed in a certain amount of time. And I think I've also heard you say that often the progress is happening after the insight is happening, but after the session, between sessions. Sometimes we don't find out until 6 months later or never.
I did a supervision with somebody recently and that they brought a question about, it didn't seem that this particular person was making much progress in the session. And the coach had a slight concern that they were asking for stuff to take away and the coach felt they were putting too much in. And I said, what? And then they said, and then they'd come back next time and report on it. And I said, what fantasy are we in when we expect all the work to be done in the session? You know, if you actually said the session was a moment to catch up, to work out what the next bit of work was and then go away and do the other work, the next bit of work, and then come back and report back on that because that served them, then what an amazing thing. I've done for years and years and years single session coaching with somebody, and he pops up every so often. And the first few times I worked with him, I used to get really bothered because he just basically used the whole session to report back.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd say, is this useful? And of course, he wasn't reporting back on anything because it was a single session. So he wasn't reporting back on what he'd done since the last session. And we had a conversation about it. And he said, the way I use coaching is I put an appointment with you in my diary. And that means that I have to get my act together in the 2 or 3 days beforehand and do all the things that I really, really deep down know I need to do. And then I come and tell you I did it.
Ah, classic accountability.
So would you use that if you were applying for accreditation? No, you wouldn't. Is it a justified and valuable way of coaching? Yes. And the same with the person that I was just talking about who was doing the work between every session and then kind of reporting back. Would you use that as a recording? No. Is it valid coaching? Yes. Yes, it is.
Because it helps somebody make progress.
Yes. And, you know, this fantasy about nailing people to their goals, please. We're never going to get, they are never going to get all the way.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another goal and there's another goal and we need to do this and we need to pin this down and we need to do the other. No, we don't. We don't. And anyway, some people hate goals.
Yeah, absolutely. And also it's really also in the way we ask, in the way we start the session. I've heard you talk about the how are you often being perceived as a past focused question, right? Yes. Just how are you? And what I'm trying to ask when I ask the question is what's present for you as you're tuning into this?
Yeah.
You know, how are you being right now? What's going on for you?
Yeah.
But when you ask what's going on for you, bam, you're in the past. You know, I kind of want to ground, I want to ground ourselves in the present so that we can be really present as we are spending this time together. But usually when we ask somebody what's present for you, even when you say what's present for you right now, what are your sensations, you know, as we are here right in this moment, 90% of people tell you what they've done in the last week.
Yeah.
And if we ask a question that's future focused, you know, then I can see that single session working really well because you're already starting off not opening the door into the past, but really being curious about what do we need to do here together for you to progress.
Yeah.
But the question I wanted to ask in there is about, well, relational practice, right? For me, the coaching relationship is the driver for any good progress that is being done here. It is you and me in relationship.
Yep.
And when we don't have that, tell me a bit about who you are. Tell me a bit of your story. You know, that getting to know part of the chemistry session or the first encounter, if we jump straight in, I've seen it work, but I'm wondering about what's possible without having established that beforehand, or is it something that just is being established as you're working together forward? What was it like for you?
So I love that new insights come out in dialogue, don't you? So what you were describing there is tell me a bit about you, I'll tell you a bit about me. That's a relational connection, isn't it? Sorry, that's an informational connection.
Depends.
So it's a bit of sharing information. It's a bit of sharing information back. I think the thing about single session coaching is they trust the process before they come.
Mm-hmm.
And because single session isn't a big thing yet, most people who come to us have been referred by somebody else.
Right. So there is already a relationship in some way.
Yes.
There's a base level of trust.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And if I don't know somebody, I just say to them, so what do we need to do before we start doing some work so that you trust me enough to do that?
Ah, right. And you would say it like that.
Yep. And they always accept for once. Once he said, I need to tell you a whole lot of stuff. But everyone else had gone, nothing, actually. I'm good to go. And then they're ready to work. So,
right.
So it's a relational question. What do we need to do before we start working so that you trust me enough to do this work? That's the relational connecting thing.
Yeah.
But I'm also saying I trust you. And then in that moment, they're saying they trust me. And then off we go.
Great.
And the one Oh, I remember that one.
Yeah, clearly.
I would never ever be able to see him in the street and know it was him, but I can remember. So he arrived with his head down and slouched in his chair sideways, and I thought, oh no, this is going to be hard. He'd been referred, and he just said he had to tell me a lot of bad stuff about his organization. We had a two-hour session. After half an hour, I said, have you said everything that you need to say to be able to do some work? And he went, yeah. We did 90 minutes, really good work. And then he went, I wish I hadn't done that at the beginning.
Oh.
He said, I realized that that was a really valuable thing and I wasted it. He said, I wasted a quarter of it.
Wow.
But because it was a single session, he didn't come back. So yeah. He didn't learn from his learning, but that was really useful, but it's only happened once.
Okay. So would you, if people do come to you and feel they tell you a bit of their story, would you ever stop that? No. I mean, you're asking them, so if they feel that's important to them, you probably wouldn't.
And also, time makes things the right size. Mm-hmm. So if we have an hour and I say, is there anything we need to talk about before we start so that we can do some good work? You know, we've got an hour, so you're not going to spend an hour telling me about the past.
Yeah.
So, I mean, people do go backwards. And I just say, is this useful? Or I ask a turning round question to try and encourage them to stand in it and look forwards.
Yeah.
So I might say, as you say that about the past, what mm-hmm. do you notice in mm-hmm. the present? And that mm-hmm. often helps turn it round.
Right. So you're coming in with a future focus. Even when you hear something about the past, you will just naturally be curious about how is it going to help us progress?
Well, I just want them to be doing the work.
Because,
mm-hmm. you know, people say, and I've got 25 direct reports and this has happened and this has happened and this has happened and this has happened. And so I'll say, so as you hear yourself saying that, what do you notice?
Mm-hmm.
Because that makes them go, oh. Whereas if I interrogate the past, we go further back into the past.
Mm-hmm.
And if I try and say, if a lot of what happens in that moment when the coach wants to go, knows that the conversation needs to move forward and they're going backwards, a lot of what happens in that moment is that the mm-hmm. is that the thinker can feel mm-hmm. told off by the coach.
Mm-hmm.
So the coach says, when we started out, we said we were going to talk about your relationship with your colleague Jane, and now we're talking about the whole structure of the entire organization. And the thinker goes, oh no, I did something wrong there. And then they start following.
Yeah. I mean, whenever I would be curious about something like that, I just want to make sure that this is the best use of our time. Yeah. I mean, I want to honor that you brought something in that you wanted to talk about. We're now talking about this. Is this related? Is this helpful? Is this valuable?
Yeah.
Or have we diverted and would you like to bring it back to what you had said in the beginning, you know, because that's how I want to honor the contract. And I guess that's why the contracting is important to me.
Or what do we need to do now? Because often actually, whatever we agreed we were doing isn't the thing that we actually need to do, because it will change, won't it? And we have to agree again.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's why I see a lot of coaches holding on to the initial contract, because there's this idea that contracting is done at the beginning and then it's set. And it's just such a fluid, complex thing, you know, when in essence, it's quite simple. It's what do you want to do now? That's the contract. That's the only contract that matters, really.
Yeah, the contract is never the contract. But when the one we agreed at the beginning, we have to agree the one at the beginning to get us starting in any direction, I think. But then we have to hold it lightly and check in with them.
Yeah.
So are we talking about your relationship with Jane, or are we talking about your big organizational problems?
Uh-huh.
And then if I get a sense that what they've said is the easy option, I'll just say, so how are we going to know at the end? So you contract the whole thing again. How are we going to know at the end that this has been really useful?
Yeah, and usually your relationship with Jane illustrates the big organizational issues anyway.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm. Yeah, yeah.
There was somewhere else. Yes, let's go there first. I've been thinking about practice. I've heard this, basically there's this freestyle rapper who's just so far beyond the best freestyle rapper I've ever heard. It's mind-blowing. And like, I'm just like, how does this guy's mind work? Which is already fascinating. But then I saw a video of him practicing and kind of going through one of his practice routines. Turns out he's been a jazz drummer since he was 7. And practice has always been a part of his life. So I've been thinking lately about, well, how do we practice coaching? With music, it's a little bit easier because a lot of it can be done on your own. But there's a lot of parts of practicing to be a better coach that we can do on our own. And then we can sit down with colleagues or friends or practice clients or coaching clients to get better. So given that you thought a lot about how to simplify coaching and what we could actually do to become better coaches, I wonder if you could give us some ideas of how we might sit down and simplify our coaching. Are there some practical steps that you could recommend that people could do out there?
Well, first of all, every single person we have a conversation with is our teacher. And some of them are teachers we like to be with, and some of them are teachers where we're a bit embarrassed. But you know, use every person you coach as your teacher. That's one piece. And I think the other one is, don't think that becoming a better coach is purely about practicing coaching conversations.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So you can practice different bits in different places. Mm-hmm. So when we're teaching about listening, and in the book it talks about headlines and underbelly, one of the things that I now know that I didn't even know when I finished the book is that reflective or paraphrasing listening, we often feed back information that the person knows already. Mm-hmm. So you have 25 direct reports and you live in Birmingham. That's the bit they know. Mm-hmm. But practice in other contexts, in meetings, in conversations, practice offering back themes or feelings. Mm-hmm. When it isn't coaching. So it might be that when somebody says, I have 25 direct reports and I live in Birmingham and I work in Scotland, you might go, so that's a lot. That's quite a large number of people and quite a big commute.
Mm-hmm.
So practice those things. So look at some of the bits and practice them. I think the big shift for me in my coaching was on which was actually after I got my MCC, was my exploration into coaching presence,
mm-hmm.
which I've done through all kinds of means. And I'm just moving from theatre improv, which I'm not giving up, because that's way. And we run a day on presence with an improv teacher, and I'm there. And we did it the other day. I laughed more than I've laughed the last 2 years.
Huh.
And it's painfully difficult learning. But one of the things that I think I'm learning at the moment is that many of us, when we ask a question, we make a statement.
Mm.
So it sounds like a question. It looks like a question, but it sounds like a statement. Actually, it needs to sound like an offer.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned that from improv.
How so?
Because in improv, you have to make an offer. And you also have to not know what you're going to do when you go on into the sketch. You don't. Mm-hmm. You have no idea what you're going to do. You have to go in and you have to make an offer. Mm-hmm. I think improv is a really great piece of development for coaches. So that's another piece. Yeah. So I think don't necessarily feel that all your practice needs to be coaching.
Mm-hmm.
But so I take a bit. So presence has been my learning journey for 6 years. Mm. And I'm now and it's expanded into power and privilege. So now I'm embarking on learning around white power and white privilege and mm-hmm. difference and all those things. So your practicing bits can look different. So one of the things that Stuart does on the presence training is get people to walk into a room when they don't know what they're going to say and they just have to hold the space. That's really good learning in presence.
Uh-huh. I've seen someone do an exercise where you have to give a TED talk, but you have to improvise it. So somebody reveals the topic as soon as you breathe in to start speaking.
Improv.
Yeah, I've seen a version of that where there's a slide deck as well, which is quite open to interpretation. But I just love that. And it's such a good exercise because you're forced to stay present.
Yeah, yeah. And it's about not being in control.
Yeah, exactly. Letting go of being in control. That's what makes it so scary to so many people.
But also we can't be out of control because that scares everybody.
Yeah, what's the sweet spot? And I think that's why it's important to take some of that practice out of the coaching room. Because if you're, especially when a client pays you, you know, there's limited, I think it's limited in how appropriate it is to use that space for practice. Yes. And also it's distracting because you have to keep all these balls spinning at the same time as you're trying to do this very specific piece of practice.
Yeah. So one of the things I'm recommending to quite a few coaches at the moment who are who are a long way down their learning, and they're saying, but I can't get recordings from the, because of confidentiality, I can't record anybody I work with. I say, well, why don't you take on
a couple of recorded clients? Yeah.
A pro bono client who'll work with you for 4 sessions. You can record them, but equally offer somebody, say, I want to try out this thing. Mm-hmm. But if you're trying out something, make sure you're still working in partnership and you're not doing it to them. That's what I would say. Just be cautious. And the other thing about practicing coaching is don't practice with other coaches too much.
Mm-hmm.
Because coaching coaches is not the same as coaching real people. Sorry, not that we're not real
people. Quite a slip there. I know what you mean.
Because partnership when you're coaching a coach is probably too much partnering, because they know how to dance with you and you're fluent at dancing. They're probably fluent at dancing, or you're both learning dancing and there's a way you can dance together. Yeah. Actually, we only become great coaches by coaching people who aren't coaches. And actually, in terms of my journey, probably single session coaching has been a really good piece of learning there.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1998, I went to a talk in London by Thomas Leonard, who the Americans say is the grandfather of coaching, although nobody in Europe much has heard of him.
he founded U Coach, no? And did he found the ICF?
He founded Coach U, and he founded the ICF. He was one of the founders of the ICF.
Yeah.
And he said, go out and coach 1,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've coached a lot more than 1,000 people, and everyone's been different. And I think that's where I've learned that I don't know how to coach anyone and that we need to work it out together.
Yeah.
So I would say, if you want to practice, a great way and a great business model, although I'm now telling you to all be in competition with me. You know, offer single session coaching, because it's a really great way to master the art. And it goes along with that, those very wise words, which would go out and coach 1,000 people.
Yeah. And it really is going to get your rapport building skills up, because you have to build relationship quite quickly when you do single session coaching.
Yeah. And you have to trust the process.
Uh-huh.
And you have to have enough presence and trust between you to be able to get on with it quickly without a great big backstory. I think it's a great way to develop.
Yeah. Hey, I'm having an eye on the time, and I really still wanted to ask you about power and partnership, because I know it's something that you're currently really passionate about. You know,
how long have you got?
How long have you got is the question. I don't have anybody. I know, I actually do have somebody booked in after. Let me quickly check. I've got another 20 minutes.
Okay, perfect.
What would be a helpful way to phrase my question?
That's a very good question. Partnership is at the heart of how the ICF describe coaching. Mm-hmm. When coaching wobbles, it's usually because partnership is imbalanced. But you can't talk about partnership without talking about power. And that comes from my colleague did a piece of training last week with somebody as a delegate. And she came back and she said, there really is a word called pedestaling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Putting someone on a pedestal. So, you know, one of the things that I'm experiencing now, you know, since the book came out is quite a lot of pedestaling.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to go, but I am honestly a human being, and I'm don't guru me.
Yeah, and that's the first thing you said very quickly. And yeah. I think that's part of the context. And I've noticed that as well. I have to work a lot harder now to create a relationship at eye level. And I think that's what you mean by partnership. A partnership is a relationship with equal power dynamics.
Yes. And the real issue with partnership is if you're working with somebody and they give you power,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't matter how well trained you are not to take power. You've mm-hmm. still got it because they gave it to you.
Right.
And that therein lies the issue for coaches, because coaches, when I first started talking about power, people would say, but I know how to not take power. And I'm going, yeah, but that doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
How do you disarm yourself then?
Well, there's something about how you sit. There's something about tone. There's something about who speaks first. Yannick, mm-hmm. going back to what you said earlier, there's a lot about who speaks first. There's about how much we say. There's something about tone. Are we making, is our tone of statements, in which case that up-powers us, mm-hmm. or is it an offer which equalizes us?
Mm-hmm.
How do we, my mum used to say visitors first. When we had people around to the house mm-hmm. to eat, which was pretty much all the time, she used to say visitors first. So they would always take the food first and mm-hmm. we would go second. But, you know, the power dynamics, their question is probably better than mine.
Mm-hmm.
So if they look like they're about to say a question to themselves, then I need to defer and I need to give them the capacity to do that. But I also think the next big deep dive of my learning is, in order to be able to look at power, I also need to own my own privilege.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And not only do I need to own my own privilege, but I also need to own the privilege that people give me that I might not even have.
Yeah, or might not even recognize.
Yes. And in order for people to keep their own personal power
mm-hmm.
in coaching, I need to do nothing that takes away their power.
Mm-hmm.
So ironically, the less power they have in the room, the more I need to be really attentive that I don't accidentally disempower them.
Mm. Could you give us an example for where that might happen to coaches?
Well, I'll give you a not coaching example. Mm-hmm. So if you know somebody with a stammer or a stutter,
mm-hmm.
the philosophy is don't finish their sentences for them.
Uh-huh, yeah.
So in coaching, sometimes the thinker will go silent and look slightly awkward.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going, oh dear, let me ask a question.
Yeah, let me rescue them.
Yeah. And rescuing disempowers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I am very interested in coaching around people who are dying and who have terminal illness. That's my kind of out of work interest.
Mm-hmm.
And in those spaces, it's really easy to disempower accidentally mm. by trying to be compassionate.
Yeah, with the best intentions.
Yes. And it is totally well-intentioned,
mm.
which is why I call it accidentally disempowering.
Mm-hmm.
But we can't work in partnership in coaching when the power difference is too big.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always going to be there a bit, but how do we keep equalizing it? I think that will be a lifetime's journey of getting some insight there.
Yeah. And is that something that you address and kind of recontract? Is this a conversation about it, or is that something that is just being done in order to equalize it again?
Well, sometimes I think you have to name it. Mm-hmm. You know, I wonder if you're giving me some power here.
Mm-hmm.
Liz Price, who's a coach that we've interviewed on our Coaching In podcast, she did a really interesting one with me where she was describing some learning she'd done, where they were talking about naming difference and naming power differences and naming privilege.
Mm-hmm.
And the more I coach people of color, who are pretty much now the only people that I'm coaching, and that's my choice,
mm-hmm.
Because I'm doing so much more supervision and writing and everything else. And it's because it's a great place for me to keep learning and keep dealing with stuff. And the more I am open to being open about it,
mm-hmm.
the more I notice the honesty comes into the space.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a huge honor. Where you can and I depower by what I wear.
You what by what you wear?
I depower by what I wear. And I know if you're in corporate and you're going in, there's a certain expectation of dress code.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But actually I wear quite casual clothes, and I was coaching someone the other day and I had a smart casual top on. And I said, is it useful to stand up? Because they were stuck. And they went, yes. Yeah. So they stood up. And if somebody stands up, I also stand up, because otherwise we're power different. Otherwise I'm sitting down watching them standing up, and that's quite humiliating and that's disempowering.
Mm-hmm.
So I stood up and they took a step back. So I took a step back, and then they laughed and they went, you're wearing shorts. But you know, that was a very equalizing moment.
Uh-huh.
That was a beautifully equalizing moment. So I think that it's going to be different for every single one of us. But I think the thing that we need to be thinking about is what needs to happen in this space to equalize the power, and how will I know when they've given power to me that I don't deserve, or actually power to me that I do deserve?
Mm-hmm.
Because that makes us the guru, the expert, the whatever. And then we wonder why it's a bit bumpy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's usually in the quality of the relationship or partnership.
Yes, yes. And it's and the quality of the partnership is massively affected by how much power they give or take. In the presence day the other day, Stuart, the trainer, got us to do an exercise where we had to say hello. We had to walk around the room and say hello to people. I hope I'm not betraying all his trade secrets. But we had to say hello to people when we were feeling personally powerful, or when we were feeling weak or cross or whatever. And we did it. It was fun. It was huge fun. But I walk 2 hours a day, and I live in a place now where everybody says hello. But what I'm noticing is I'm really noticing how people say hello. So there's the person who looks you in the eye and goes, hello.
Uh-huh.
And then there's the person with their head down who goes hello. And that gives us some really good insights into the people's own perception of their own personal power. Now, our relationship is half a second, except with the badger man who tells me where the badgers are. And my relationship with him is about 20 minutes every morning, especially when I'm about to go into a coaching session. But you, I'm not one to say body language tells us that, but I think my sense, you know, the question is not what are they doing that indicates whether there's power there or not, but it's what am I sensing?
Mm-hmm.
What am I sensing about the personal power in this space between mm-hmm. you and I?
Yeah.
And therefore, what needs to be spoken and named? What needs to be noticed and paid attention to and not named?
Yeah.
Because if I name it now, it's just going to make it bigger.
Exactly. That's what I was just thinking. Like, we need to kind of acknowledge it and name it in order to talk about it and equalize it. But also, if I'm naming it, I might assert some power here that might be counterproductive.
Yeah. And then I mean, as we're talking, it makes me think about all sorts of things, because then you can get into shame and guilt and mm-hmm. all sorts of stuff. So I just want to go sense it, notice it, and work out together what you need to do. But before you work out together what you need to do, just do a sense check.
Yeah.
Is what I'm about to do or say about to do the opposite of my intention?
Exactly. And I mean, it is always, and I rarely say always, but like, I think it's always important when it becomes relevant to what they bring into the coaching space, right? If what they want from the coaching seems to be directly or indirectly related to how they're showing up in this relationship.
Yeah.
Because our dynamics of power, they usually show up in other relationships that this client, this coachee has, or that our working partner has.
I like that. Just a bit shift there. And another way to explore it with someone who is where you're wondering whether their personal power is low is, I've done a lot of interview coaching. Not in the last 10 years, but before that, I did a lot.
Coaching to interview better?
Supporting people to be able to turn up in the room.
Uh-huh.
And often I would say to people, are you okay to stand up and let's try, you know, shall we try out some of the questions that you want to try out? And they'll say, oh yes, ask me this. So you ask them that. But I say, are you okay to stand up? And then you discover when they stand up that they're standing on one leg.
Oh.
Or they're sort of sideways.
Uh-huh.
And you've then got a visible thing which shows you that they're not fully present in their body.
Mm-hmm.
So then I'd say, is it okay if you stand on both feet? Now try that again. And the tone changes completely. And then the question is, so what do you need to do to go into the interview?
Yeah.
So that you feel that you can, you know, that you can show up with your personal power, not having left it outside the door. So it can be managed in lots of different ways. Mm. But certainly when people are, and most of the coaching that I do is standing up,
mm-hmm.
because it's pacier. And also you get much more of a view of the whole body.
Yeah.
And you can move and dance and, well, I mean, not dance as in that kind of dance, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. It's amazing how much of power and also coming from that confidence lies in how we hold ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, just occasionally, just like straightening my back and sitting more upright, getting the chest out, you know, I just notice how it affects my thinking.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Yeah. Totally.
I really want to get a standing desk. You know, I just need to figure out what to do with all the tech.
If you get a standing desk from a popular Swedish store, it has a basket underneath for all your wires, and the tech goes up and down at the same time because the wires are attached to the desk and not to the wall. That's my top tip.
Yeah, I would need to have baskets all around this desk. there's some stuff.
Okay.
But that would take us away from the conversation we're having. I think it's just really important that we recognize power as something incredibly important, especially given that coaching rests on this relationship, that we can build this relationship quite quickly. But also I think this is where the skill comes in, that we very quickly, especially in the context of single session coaching, very quickly establish that kind of partnership at eye level. And that we explore or name or acknowledge or equalize power that has been given to us, kind of question that, or just by something very simple, for example, standing up and not wearing proper pants, that we just bring that back to this so that the client can take ownership of where this is going.
Because in the end, we are two human beings.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not special with magical superpowers. You know, the magic's in them, and our job is to support them to find it.
Mm-hmm. I love that. I think this is a really good point to finish, unless you can think of another point or a message or something that you would love to give to people.
I don't think I can follow that.
Well, it is a high point. It's definitely a highlight. Cool. Well, then I'm happy to leave it here. I do always ask if people wanted to be more in your sphere, learn from you more, possibly work for you. That's another slip here. You know, be in relationship with you, whether that may be working towards their own MCC or renewing some of their accreditation. The book is obviously a really good pointer. Where else can people find you? Where would be a good thing to follow you?
The website, www.3dcoaching.com. Mm-hmm. The podcast, which is The Coaching Inn on all major podcast platforms, and the blog, which you can sign up for at the website, or you can get it on all social media, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. All I would say is, normally I say, connect to me on LinkedIn. I'm going on a 10-week sabbatical.
Excellent.
And switching off all social media. So the best way to get hold of me at the moment is to talk to my team, mm-hmm. who will be carrying everything while I'm away.
That is fantastic. Claire, thank you so much for your insights, your learning, your perspective, your work. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. And thank you for co-learning, because I've had some learning there too.
Good. Well, that's what dialogue's all about. So
exactly.
I'm sure we'll run into each other again soon. Enjoy your sabbatical. I can't wait what you come back with. Second book is on the way, going deeper on simplifying coaching, I hear.
Yes, there is a second book coming, which will be coming out in November 2023.
Fantastic. Well, I can't wait. Claire, thank you for your time once more. And
thank you.
And goodbye.
And thank you everyone for listening. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Coaching Uncaged. If you want to find out more about becoming a coach, developing your coaching skills further, or training as a coaching supervisor, then head along to animascoaching.com. Thanks again, and catch you on the next episode.